This is Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson. Sponsored by Know Better, Do Better, KBDB. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Dr. Phil Knight.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for listening. Oswald Sanders once wrote, "Leadership is influence, nothing more and nothing less." It's a short sentence, but if leadership really is influence, then influence shapes outcomes. It shapes policy, it shapes systems, it shapes whether families can access food when they need it most. At Food Secure Nation, we talk often about access. It sounds simple. Can people get food? But the more you sit with that question, the more complicated it becomes. Access depends on income, on benefit design, on technology, on political stability, on climate, and on trust. And behind all those are leaders, people whose influence quietly shapes whether access expands or contracts. Today, we're joined by someone who has spent their career influencing access from every vantage point, from shaping national SNAP policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities to administering those programs at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to now leading the Global Food Institute at George Washington University, thinking about food systems in a global context. This isn't a conversation about a single program. It's a conversation about what real access looks like and what it takes to build it. Stacy Dean, the director for the Global Food Institute at George Washington University, joins us next on this edition of Food Secure Nation. Welcome back, everyone. Jerry Brisson, Dr. Phil Knight, and with our guest, Jerry, I'm not even saying anything to you because our guest today is way too important, Stacy Dean. Stacy, welcome back to Food Secure Nation.
Oh, I am so delighted to be back. It's good to be with old friends.
It's great to have you. You're now currently serving as the director for the Global Food Institute at George Washington University. But wow, let's go all the way in the hot tub time machine back a little bit to your days at the center and catch everybody up. These three big stops you've had in your career, and because it seems to me like there's a driving force, a thread, a tapestry, if you will, through all three of those positions, how to help create access for food for people who need help with food security issues.
Well, thanks for that question. And, you know, I think you're exactly right. I have spent my whole career, and it's been building over time with more and different kinds of experiences. So I started work at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a research and advocacy group here in D.C. So as what they call a policy wonk, as it were. I remember telling some of my husband's friends that I worked at a think tank, and they just thought that was the most hilarious phrase they had ever heard in their lives, as folks who made an honest living. But a big part of what we did was just try to make sure that policies, government spending, regulations that were designed to help those struggling to afford enough to eat worked and worked well. So I did that for a couple of decades before getting the honor of my career, which was to work for the Biden administration and Secretary Vilsack at USDA. And there I got to lead the food and nutrition program. So SNAP, school meals, WIC, funding for food banks, all 16 of them. And that was an incredible joy. And I think that I was there the last time I joined the podcast and
yeah.
talked mm-hmm. to you about some of the work we were doing. And now I didn't think it could get better, but really I've joined a university to stand up a food institute. And the idea here is that we're working to leverage the power of the whole university, all five schools, from engineering to public health to the arts, the liberal arts, to basically tackle this incredible challenge that we have of wanting to build a better food future. And how do we work in an interdisciplinary way and bring the strength and power of a university in really this urgent question in front of us, which is how to feed the planet in a sustainable, equitable way.
And you're looking at the whole planet.
The whole planet, yes. I don't think we can just solve it for here in the United States. So it's a great place to be. And just as I was feeling a little bit old, I get to spend my time with very young people who energize me every day.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, this is just a curious question, but do you integrate this sort of higher level thinking with work that might be happening on the ground at the university? Like, does the university also run a food pantry or something, you know, that's really directly serving people who have these needs?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, the GW, to answer your question, does have a food pantry, but we also have this incredible professor here, Gabby Hedrick. She's at the School of Public Health, and she's been doing quite a bit of research on the incidence of hunger and food insecurity amongst college students. And what's riding alongside with that? What are the other challenges these students face? And how then can universities in turn think about the kinds of supports we can offer students who are struggling? So yes, we think about it on our campus in terms of the supports we offer, the learning opportunities, right, to expand our global perspectives on food as well as research and education.
So thank you for the hitting those three high points for us. Now I want to go back just a little further. And I want to ask you, Stacy, how did you come to care so much about people and about this issue?
Well, I think, I, you know, like with all of us, I suppose some of it started in childhood. I had parents who cared deeply about their community. My mom was a school social worker. And sort of contributed in that way. And my father was a deacon in our church. And mm-hmm. So a big part of our lives was faith, but also giving back. Hmm. So I think that was how I measured let me put it a different way. That was the standard against which I wanted to measure my life or my work.
Right.
And so, but that having been said, I'm kind of an analyst, a spreadsheet kind of person. And so I went to, you guys may remember that I went to the University of Michigan and got a public policy degree there and just started thinking about how can I use these skills to give back? So I very early in my career worked for government and started working on as a budget analyst for the food assistance programs, and really appreciated that I was working on something that mattered so much to so many people, and then wanted to keep doing work to see those programs, which were incredibly strong, even stronger and more powerful, because the problem or the challenge they were trying to solve was pretty formidable, and that's hunger.
I love that. And go blue, by the way.
Yeah. Well, now it's buff and blue here at TW.
Right.
We're having to make that color palette change.
Well, yeah, true. You know, but for those of us who are colorblind, we are blissfully ignorant.
There you go.
So, you know, thinking about moving from the think tank, you know, and I love the line about honest living. So,
yeah.
And then into the USDA, where you're really responsible for implementation of food and nutrition programs. I'm curious to know, from moving from that position to inside the USDA and leading that work, did your perspective about access, did your understanding about access, people having access to the food they want and need, how much did it change? How did it change? I know it changed, but.
Yeah, I think I got a deeper appreciation of some of the access challenges that families were facing, partly because I was talking with community leaders from those places and spaces saying, we need help. whether it was faith leaders who felt that we weren't able to provide them through the food bank system with our support that we offered there, foods that were responsive to their faith tradition, or leaders from Alaska who had, you know, just had communities living on the Aleutian Islands, very remote parts of our country. And those were citizens who needed our help just as much as the folks that live down the street from me here in Washington, D.C. So it, I also think areas around the territories, you just got a deeper understanding when you were pulled into the challenges that communities face. And it was my job that time not to opine on it or write about it, but actually to solve the problem.
Yeah. So actually solving the problem really gets thorny.
But yeah, no kidding.
It's part of the reason, though, that we like to build frameworks so you can talk about the different dimensions of a problem. And we like the six dimensions of food security because it's complicated enough. It's not a complicated idea, but it allows for a lot of variation in how you have to think about the solution. So is the problem related to the availability of food or access to food or how the food is being used in the household or whether the food program is stable and sustainable or even down to is it the food that the consumer has said they want and need or the design of the program, what they want and need. And when you take all those dimensions and you put them together, you can handle variations like people living on the Aleutian Islands versus people living in New York City.
Right, right. I really like the framework. Just as you said, you know, it's not whether it's food, whether food exists, whether people can acquire it, right? Use it healthfully, rely on it, as you said, shape, and then have a voice in shaping their own food environment and making it sustainable for their future. So, you know, food isn't a linear issue. It's very much a system and a system that I think has grown up largely shaped by markets, but also by government and policy intervention. And I think now we're trying to get a better handle on all the components of it, so that we can shape it better for the future.
And you can honor all of the work in some kind of way, but then still point to where the gaps still are without insulting anybody, right? At least that's the hope.
Yeah, right.
Well,
I think that's right.
So I was ready to take a break, but you, Jerry, had to get that last comment in. So let me take a break here. We're going to come back with our friend, colleague, and just awesome person, Stacy Dean. She's back with Jerry and myself in just a moment.
You're listening to Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson, sponsored by Know Better, Do Better.
Welcome back, everyone. Dr. Phil Knight here with you. Jerry Brisson across from me. Hi, Jerry. I didn't greet you last time.
Well, you didn't want me to say anything, but I still got some words in.
You did. Okay. The reason I didn't want you to say anything is because Stacy Dean is our guest today. She is the executive director at the Global Food Institute that is housed inside George Washington University. So, Stacy, so happy to have you. And we're starting to unpack some of this idea around the six dimensions of food security and particularly about access, because that's been a thread that's kind of ran through your career and how you have invested your one handful of life to making this place and this world better. And I'm excited not only about the national conversation about food insecurity, but I'm excited that you're really having an emphasis and a leadership position on a global perspective. Because for me, I spent almost 10 years living and working overseas, particularly in East Africa, and I have seen poverty. I mean, I tell the story of a little baby girl who was just could hold in one hand, and the nurse asked me about her. And I said, asked me how old she was. And I said, oh, I think she's 8 weeks. And the nurse said, no, Phil, she's 8 months. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that picture out of my mind. And I'm not supposed to. and it's one of the reasons it drives me to do this work. So I appreciate greatly the emphasis of a global food initiative.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I think the six dimensions of food security, what I love about it so much is that it really can work in any country, any community. And it's a great way to engage the players, as we were talking about before the break, of what are the strengths that we have in our community, because every community has inherent strengths. The people, the infrastructure, the services that are there, and then compare that to where we want to be, right? And then think about what are the gaps that we've got to address to get from where we are to where we want to be. It's a very empowering framework, too. Hmm. It's not deficit-oriented, and I like that about it.
You know, we had at Gleaners, and we worked with Forgotten Harvest to have a delegation come and talk to us from Africa about food banking. And we learned a few really important things. One was, if you don't have roads for trucks to drive on, you have a very different logistical challenge.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's so many things that change in these different environments, but the framework allows for that. You know, you talk about access and you say, if you even have the food, but you can't get to it, then you have to solve that before that food can actually be an answer for somebody who's struggling. Right. Mm-hmm. And so how do you think about your role looking at the global issues of food security? And I can't imagine that ecology doesn't come into play. I can't imagine that food waste doesn't come into play. I mean, there's got to be a pretty broad perspective on a lot of things when you're talking about the global situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, of course, we're not saying that we can solve it all right here at GW. We're a part of a big ecosystem working to build a better food future. What we're trying to do is make sure that we're leveraging all parts of the university where different professors or centers have relationships and are working on food issues overseas. So you made an excellent point about ecology or sustainability. I think we now understand that the food system contributes, for example, about 25 to 30% of our climate change problem. And so we have to tackle the food system with respect to food waste, producing food in a less environmentally damaging way, and, of course, dealing with that issue of growing enough food given the available land that we have in the future. So that's one whole set of issues that plays out differently depending upon whether you're an island nation, a desert, or a very abundant, agriculturally abundant country like the United States. But again, going back to this framework, it can really help guide a structured conversation about the assets that you have and the tools that you're going to need to leverage them all. And can we just spend a minute talking about that question of access? I think Phil or Jerry, I'm not sure which one of you were talking about. Oh, Jerry, it was roads.
Yep.
Mm. You know, I think of access, if it's do you have the resources, the proximity, because you got to be able to get there, the mobility, which is about roads or personal mobility, and safety. And with those four, you can really think about, do we have access to us here? And if not, what are the drivers of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you different people along my path have struck different chords there. Like working with Ford Motor Company, for example, mobility is a key thing for them, right? And one of the things we worked with them on was, how do we drive that skill to provide access? How do we use mobility experts from Ford Motor Company to help drive access? And it was a really robust conversation. So I am very interested in, how are your professors working with each other? I mean, how are they? I mean, do you have virtual meetings? Do you have one-off conversations? I mean, how do you organize that many people?
Well, you know, every environment has this different way of getting together, universities, governments, nonprofits. So here, one of the things folks like to do when we're trying to tackle our, again, what the skills we have relative to the challenges that are out in the world, is we do what's called a research sandbox. which is essentially gathering together for a day and digging in on research questions that are of interest to different disciplines, and then spending the time kicking off a conversation, kicking the tires, as it were, and determining, okay, is this a group of people who want to start coming together, let's say once a week, once a month, to dive into that question, and then ultimately to form a research agenda where they go together after grants or partnerships to pursue the questions. So an interesting one we've been thinking about lately is this question of food access. And one of the ways that, you know, we've historically looked at food access in the United States is an individual's proximity to a full-service grocery store or some kind of store. And there's a lot of different measures that looks at that, that USDA has put out. But now, since those measures came out originally, we've had this whole new form of food access roll out in front of us, and that's food delivery, the Instacarts and the Safeway.coms and all this online ordering and delivery availability. So how do you layer that on to assess food access for an individual or a community? That's been an interesting question we've been kicking around.
I'll tell you, we're training an AI assistant right now. We call her Vera. We've been training her for 6 months to learn how to look at what information is available and score or weigh the relative value of that information based on how much research there is. And I mean, it's been a fascinating process. But this is a really good example of where AI isn't perfect, because things evolve that AI doesn't know about. And so you can't just go to AI to get all your answers. I love that you have a group of people getting together and you do your research sandbox, because that is the thing that that artificial intelligence can't do. It can't. You have to have people who have relevant experience talking together about what's happening now in order to inform artificial intelligence, which is a powerful tool, but it's not going to solve the problem by itself.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, we want to pull together. You can answer a lot of different questions. They don't all have the same, answering them doesn't all have the same impact, right? There are different size problems. And that's the other thing that I think our academics working with practitioners like yourselves in the field, like, what is an urgent question that answering it would have a high impact and change lives today? So we still think humans are pretty useful for that work, as well as other things. Teaching our students is another pretty critical area. But integrating AI into how we think about our work and the tools we have available to us is important as we scope for the future.
Well, this is fascinating, and we get to do it one more time with you, Stacy. So everyone, stay with us. Jerry, Stacy, and myself, Dr. Phil, will be back with you. Don't go away. Welcome back. Dr. Phil Knight here with Jerry Brisson and our very, very, very special guest, Stacy Dean, who serves at the Global Food Institute at George Washington University after a stop in the USDA and then at the Center for Budget Policy and Priorities. So, Stacy, you've been trying to create access for people to have the food they want and need with your one hand full of life. And it's been amazing to watch you, to listen to you. You've been on the show with Jerry and I. And despite that, you decided to come back today. So we definitely appreciate it. But here's a question to start our third segment with you. And this is kind of broad, so just jump in anywhere you want. If you could redesign access from scratch, what would it begin to look like?
What a wonderful question. The idea of dreaming like that is just not where we usually start, right? We roll up our sleeves and solve the problem in front of us.
Right.
I think we have an incredibly efficient and amazing food system here in the United States, just for example. Right. Even though food feels very unaffordable for families today, in general, over the past few decades, we've produced a lot of food incredibly efficiently at relatively good prices. And I think that is a strength that we want to keep. But it may have, I don't think it may have. It has had some difficult results that we haven't necessarily wanted, which is, I'm not sure we're rewarding farmers sufficiently there. I'm not sure we're rewarding food workers sufficiently there. And we have too many people who just are priced out or accessed out of the food system. And so the question is, how can we step back and recalibrate to build in those values in the food system? And it might mean thinking about the food system more as a utility. You know, when we think about, did electricity get everywhere it needs to go? It's not completely market-based. And before your listeners start to worry that I'm some kind of crazy communist or something, rest assured,
too
I am
late.
Not.
Too late.
It's not doing all the things I think that we want as a society. Mm-hmm. And that's we don't want people not being able to afford food. We don't want folks living in remote areas not having fresh, delicious, nutritious food available to them. So there's a lot of different ways you can deal with those interventions through different incentives, public policy, the way we procure food, right? We have choices we can make in our food system that isn't always lowest cost, lowest cost, best price. So didn't quite answer your question, but I think it's really that we've got a good framework to work from, but we've got to start nudging it to do the things where it's falling short.
Well, and one of the things we think a lot about is how do we talk about what do you need to highlight? And by that, I mean, what is measurable progress? What are the things that need to be on a board somewhere that somebody's looking at that's saying, okay, we have this. This is strong. Look at the numbers. They look great. But look at the numbers over here, which are also important, and they don't look as great. I mean, who's building that scorecard?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We actually are doing a project right now in Washington, D.C. with a community in one part of the city on this question of what would a food system look like if it delivered on all of the things that you wanted? And then how do you turn that into a dashboard, a success dashboard? And not just on sort of the deficits, like rates of diabetes and obesity and food insecurity, which should all be there. But what are some of the more immediate, the other thing I'd say is those are government data and they're often lagged. What are the things that are going to be happening and hustling every day in your community that will let us know the food system is working? It might be in some neighborhoods that crime is down and you feel safe to go to the store. It might be attendance in schools or summer youth programs where meals are available. Anyway, I think that a big part of this is not having, and this is coming from someone who ran these programs at USDA, and not having a top-down approach, but actually spending time with community members to say, what does success look like to you? And let's build the dashboard to match that.
We just had a conversation with Tori Martin from the Dorothy Johnson Center on Philanthropy, and she was talking about some eroding trust issues related to nonprofit work. And fundamentally, one of her points was, what makes you appear more competent is when the closer you are to the ground, that people want to see things on the ground. They want to see real things happening in real time, and that makes people have a higher opinion of your competence, and that grows trust. So it's interesting that your dashboard is moving in that direction because it so aligns with the research they just did about trust in the non-for-profit community and how that has to be bolstered if they're going to get to next thresholds.
I think that's right. And any dashboard you built, it has to serve both purposes, right? It needs to reflect what the community said, where they wanted to go, and what looks like success for them, as well as demonstrate to funders, taxpayers, policymakers that we're moving the needle on key metrics that maybe when you zoom out are important there as well. So this is a really evolving science, and it's the idea of taking sort of systems engineering and this idea that we've got complex systems like supply chains or even a computer system network, and we try to apply that to social problems, public health problems, and see the rich complexity that we have in those spaces as well, and not try to just tackle them with a one-off linear approach. Hmm. It devalues the depth of the concern, but also, as I keep saying, the hidden power in every community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want to leverage and where we want to invest.
Well, one more thing to that is, I was talking to someone about, root cause work versus, the immediate work of serving people who need help today. And I said to them, are the people who need help today part of the solution? And they went, and I said, if they are, you have to care for them today. Because what they can bring to the solution is unique and powerful and different compared to people who aren't in need today. So you can't just deal with one or the other. You have to deal with both because the people who need help are a hugely important part of the solution.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I don't in any way want someone to walk away thinking it's not important to deliver the core supports that folks need to get by every day, whether it's food, income, health insurance. These are really critical, and we have the means and the ability through government support to alleviate hardship, poverty, and that's critical. But you're right, connecting the folks that are getting those services to longer-term solutions is just, it's respectful and it's more powerful.
I love the phrase, and I promise the first two times I use it, I'm going to give you credit for it. after that, who knows? But anyway, the hidden power in every community. That is beautifully stated, Stacey.
Oh, thank you. I'm sure I probably lifted it from somebody else myself. So no worries. We'll just keep multiplying.
The great thing is we only steal the best stuff.
Right.
That's right. Standing on the shoulders of giants.
That's it. Well, speaking of standing on the shoulders of giants, you would be one of those giants for sure. You've given your handful of life in investing in people. And you've helped change the conversation from people who are experiencing food insecurity are needy to they are worthy of being invested in. And of all your efforts and of all your accomplishments and all of the time that you've served in making, creating access for people to have the food they want and need, I think that's one of the your top accomplishments, and we appreciate you.
Oh my goodness, what a pleasure to be here. First, to hear these wonderful compliments. We joked earlier I was going to record them and play them back to my family, but really, this is a community where everyone that we look at is a giant, and it's an honor to be a part of it and to be with the two of you. Thank you.
Well, thanks. We hope you'll come back as this conversation evolves and just be more regular with us here on Food Secure Nation.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. Jerry and I are back to wrap up this edition of Food Secure Nation in just a moment.
Secure Nation is sponsored by Know Better, Do Better. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Once again, here are Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Stacey Dean. Wow.
Yeah, every time it's wow. She's fantastic and someone with so much experience. And someone who's cared every step of her journey enough to learn more. I mean, somebody who has dedicated so much of her life to just understanding and not just having answers, but having better questions. And now at the Global Food Institute, applying all those thoughtful questions systematically to solutions. How exciting and important is that? I'm really blown away.
I know you were so excited to learn about the research sandbox.
It's going to be called the Brisson sandbox pretty soon. But
yeah. Well, somehow I don't doubt that. But the principle of it, right?
Yes, absolutely right.
Yeah, getting the people who are highly motivated, who are dedicated to finding solutions. You know, we've been saying for years that anybody can be a problem spotter. What you really need is problem solvers.
Yep.
And so spending about 20% of your time defining the problem and 80% of your time designing a solution is the right mix. I love that, among other things that she's doing. And it is, you know, it was interesting to me to hear her, the why. You know, her mom was a social worker, her dad was a deacon in a church, so their faith was a driver in service, and particularly creating access to food.
Yeah, yep, feed the hungry, baby.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot's been said on that topic on this show.
Yeah.
So Jerry, if you had to tell someone to listen to this show, the one with Stacy Dean, what would be the number one reason?
I would say if you really want to get a broader perspective on access, this is the show to listen to. If that's too wonky, to take it right to the ground and say, at some point, somebody has to be thinking about what's the next step. This is the show where we talk about people who are taking the next step.
Well, Stacy Dean has given her life, invested her life in this work, and she brought a lot of wisdom to our show today. Time for a little food for thought. Access to the food you want and need should not be rare. It should not be fragile. It should not depend on geography or luck or political cycles. Access is not a shelf. It's not a single program. And it is not a temporary fix. Access is the freedom to choose among multiple options in every zip code, in every season, for every family. No one pathway, multiple pathways. Stable systems, dignified choice. Because when access is limited, opportunity is limited. Leadership that manages scarcity maintains vulnerability. Leadership that multiplies options builds security. So the question is, are we multiplying options for everyone, everywhere? And when we answer that positively, that's how we'll have created a food secure nation.